Blog Talk Radio.
Here of the Story Blender with your host Stephen James, and Susan May Warren will be with him again tonight, talking with very special guest, best-selling author John Dixon, author of the book Phoenix Island, which became the inspiration for the hit CBS show Intelligence. So you want to make sure that you stick around and check that out. So without any further ado, let's get right into it. Here is the Story Blender, host Stephen James, talking with best-selling author John Dixon.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
I'm A. Warren.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. So, Susie, first of all, I'd like to officially welcome you as my new co-host. I really think our listeners are going to benefit a lot from both your background as a novelist and also coaching writers, even if you're not an organic writer like me.
Well, we can't all be as awesome as you, Stephen, but I am so excited to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm really
going
to have,
great to have you. And,
we're going to have a great time.
And so our guest today is John Dixon, and I met John a few years ago at Thriller Fest, which is probably the premier conference for thriller writers in the country. And I think at the time he had his first book coming out, and I just thought it was fascinating that he was a former Golden Gloves boxer, and also had worked as a middle school English teacher, which probably is a good combination that comes in handy sometimes.
No doubt.
Yeah. And John's also been a prison tutor and youth services caseworker. His book, Phoenix Island, was the inspiration for the CBS TV show Intelligence, and also won the Bram Stoker Award for Superior Achievement in a Young Adult Novel. His latest book, Devil's Pocket, hit bookstores recently to critical acclaim from Publishers Weekly, calling it adrenaline-infused. Dixon combines futuristic technical advances with graphic fight scenes for a satisfying adventure thriller. He's also written dozens of short stories that have appeared in both online and print magazines and anthologies. So, John Dixon, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me today.
Well, I have to jump in right away from the beginning and ask you about the boxing. That is so interesting. I bet that gives you good material for the fight scenes for your books.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it does. It certainly makes it a lot easier to just imagine, put yourself into the mindset of the people fighting. Because I think a lot of times when we write, we focus on the technique, but just as important as technique and fight scenes is the emotion. And I think that you know, you can figure out technique from asking people and reading about it, but I think the biggest help and having been there so many times is the psychology and the emotion of actually having fought. It does give me a lot of fodder.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've never thought of that before. For me, it's always been trying to figure out who's standing where and how they fall or don't fall, and if his foot could really kick her face and stuff like that. But
right.
Yeah, I love that about the emotion of the fight. So take us into a fight for a second. What am I feeling as I enter this fight? What's kind of going through my mind? This might be helpful for me, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really depends on the fight. You know, there are so many different types of combat, like fight combat. So, for example, when you enter a boxing match, even that, there are just so many different emotions that you go through depending on what's at stake, you know, who's your opponent, these things. So sometimes you walk into a boxing match and you're really psyched depending on who's there and what's at stake. And a lot of times, you know, you go into a boxing match and you're scared. And, you might not show it on the outside, but you're just you know, your dad's in the stands and everybody you care about it, you've invited, and once you get out there, it's just going to be you and the other guy. So you're either going to win or lose. Can't blame it on anybody else. So you can be hyped up. You can be frightened. You can be a weird blend of both. But then a fight where it's, you know, a fight that when there are no rules, that's a completely different thing, and it breaks out into any number of directions. There's a great book on that, not on writing, but on fighting, called Meditations on Violence.
Huh.
It was written by this guy named Rory Miller, who was a CERT team guy in a prison. So they would do strategic cell extractions for high-risk prisoners. And he basically throws out this matrix of real-world violence and different types of real-world violence and combat sports, and then the physiological and psychological changes that people go through during the stages of each of these different types. And that book struck me as having an awful lot of truth to it. So I think that, to involve the reader, that the fight can't just be, foot hits face, guy falls down, obviously, and we all know this. But the more that we can get the reader emotionally invested into the bout, the better. And if the reader really, really, really wants the character to win, and really, really, really wants the bad guy to get his comeuppance, then I think that they can't stop turning the pages.
Awesome. Yeah. No, that's interesting. And actually, go ahead.
I said that's fascinating. I've never heard of that before. As a person who writes romantic suspense, I hadn't thought about actually the violence having an emotional component to it. So I think that's a great book that I'm going to pick up, and clearly I need to pick up John's book so I can learn from him. So that's fantastic.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and that actually is a good bridge into one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, and that is writing for teens. Your stories are packed with intrigue, suspense, action, and in fact, one reviewer wrote about your latest thriller, it makes the Hunger Games look like Chutes and Ladders. I'm like, what? So, what do you think about violence in fiction, especially for teens? You know, are there limits to what we put on the page, or how do you evaluate that? Because I know teens are important to you. You've taught them, you've worked with them. How does that work out in the stories that you tell?
Well, I'm less worried about the violence on the page than I am about what's behind the violence. For example, the main character of my books is Carl Freeman, and he is just a force for justice. He's the son, he's an orphan, he's the son of a fallen Philadelphia police officer. And in before the first book begins, Phoenix Island, before that begins, he's in trouble again for the umpteenth time for beating up bullies. It's his only crime. He's repeated it again and again and again. He just can't stand idly by while people are pushing other people around. He always has to step in. And he fights for the right reasons. And his violence is always pointed toward justice. Now, as the first book goes on, and then the second book comes in, he's faced with some tough questions about fighting and about violence. So I think that I'm less worried about how far the violence goes, and I'm more worried about the character's attitudes, why he's fighting, and what the violence means to him, because he does have to wrestle with that.
Yeah, that's good. In the books that I write, there's some graphic violence, both in the teen books I've written, young adult books, and also for adults. And people ask me sometimes, don't you think your books desensitize people to violence? And my answer is, I think they do the opposite. They sensitize people to violence, because so much violence is meaningless in our culture. It's either muted or it's celebrated. Like, like say a slasher movie might kind of celebrate or glamorize violence, Or you might be watching a newscast and they're like, 15 people were blown up today in Baghdad and the Cubs won 5-2. And it's completely muted. And so I like to the same as you, is like, what is the context of the violence and how can we use it to actually uplift the dignity of human life and not undermine that? And I think a lot of senseless violence in books without that context of justice, like you were mentioning, actually undermines the dignity and value of human life.
Yeah, you make a great point there. And I think, too, that, you know, no matter who you are and where you stand on violence, you know, violence is one of the big questions in our world today. Like you alluded to headlines, but it's everywhere, you know, and it's not just in other countries. It's right here, and it's not just shootings. Kids playing the knockout game and it's bullying and it's just, I mean, violence is all around us, unfortunately. So, I mean, you bring to mind what another Stephen said. Stephen King talked about horror and why he writes horror, and he said that he writes horror because and reads horror because once you know shut the book, then it's over, and that it distracts him from what he considers the real horror, which is CNN. It's true.
Yeah.
It's so scary. So, I mean, at least when we're writing violence, you know, we're able to control it. It's much nicer than out in the real world where violence is just so random and, like you said, senseless.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. You know, one of the secrets I always think for any great writer is connecting with their audience. And, I mean, you've worked as a teacher, as a caseworker for teens. Back in the day, years ago, I worked for this wilderness program for teen delinquents. We would go on 30-day-long wilderness trips. We called it Hoods in the Woods. And so I worked with teens for many years, and I like to write for them, too. And so the thing is, you understand their struggles. Your books aren't just for teens, but they're kind of marketed that way very often. And you like spending time with kids. What is it that draws you to kind of this, the next generation? Or what do you hope that they take away from your books?
Well, you know, I mean, in the purest form, I hope that they're entertained.
Yeah, good.
I always hope to reach both boys and girls. But honestly, I really want to reach boys. I taught for 20 years, and I just know how tough it is to get young men invested in reading. And I looked around at the young adult landscape, and I saw, thankfully, a lot of strong female leads, which obviously wasn't always the case. But when I looked around and again at the young adult landscape, I didn't see a lot of strong male leads, a lot of strong male protagonists in middle grade fiction like Harry Potter and Percy Jackson, but not so much in young adult fiction. So I really wanted to create a character who could, when the going got tough, get just as tough. You know, he didn't get snarky. He didn't look for his team. He didn't hope for an adult to solve the problem. None of that. I wanted him to actually butt heads with the bad guys. And I guess that if there's something I want people to take away other than pure enjoyment is just the idea of not selling yourself short and not letting your circumstances in life define you, that you can, you know, by hard work and persistence that you can, you know, chart your own course. Again and again throughout these books, you have characters whose lives have really, really been tough and the cards have been stacked against them, but, you know, they make choices, and it's the choices they make that create their future. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, but I guess that sense of empowerment is important for me to get across to people.
Yeah, I like that. Go ahead, Susie.
I think that's a super great message for teens because they are in that place where they're really struggling to connect, to, you know, feel empowered, and they're at that pivotal point in their lives where they're like, am I going to be a victim, or am I going to take a hold of my future and go forward? So I think that's a really great message for boys especially, but for women too, and for girls, you know, to have that. So I'm curious, you know, we have that kind of message in a lot of, you know, like you said, Harry Potter books and that sort of thing. Where do you think that that authors who write for teens sort of go off the rails for them? How do they disconnect from teens? And so what should we be avoiding if we're writing for teens, for example?
Well, there's an awful lot of good teen fiction out there, and there are so many different ways to do it. I mean, there are just so many talented young adult authors right now. And I don't pretend to be an expert in that field. I do know from having taught readers for so many years, because I taught language arts, that some of the things that turn kids away, especially boys, are, well, they would put it quite simply, they'd say boring. And to them, boring usually means that there's a lot of exposition, a lot of description, and that, you know, there's not enough dialogue and action and twists. Mm-hmm. I think from a writer's point of view, that we all have to keep in mind that these kids who say they don't want the description and the exposition probably do want it, but they want it hidden, and they want it in smaller chunks. And mm-hmm. I think that's something that a lot of young adult fiction does really well. I think that so many young adult writers do a nice job of compressing things, collapsing things, so mm-hmm. that the stories are not self-indulgent, so the story keeps moving. And they find really oftentimes impressive ways to just do everything, character, setting development, the pacing is fast, the language is nice, and there's just not a lot of excess. So I think that we're best off when we do that. And I also think mm-hmm. that's why so many adults are now reading young adult fiction, because it's kind of refreshing sometimes to sit down to a book where you've got such a nice compressed book. There's no spare words. Mm-hmm. I look at S.E. Hinton's Rumblefish, for example, which I've probably read mm-hmm. two dozen times. And I still can't understand how she did it. It's just, it's so incredible how much she packs into that very, very short book. Mm-hmm. Just amazing.
Cool.
Yeah, I think that's true, you know, for adult fiction as well. Stories, I think we all kind of get bored by the long exposition stuff, and we all like stories that really hit home and that, you know, move well, and where there's an economy of words. That got me thinking when you mentioned that, just about the short stories you've written, John. You know, like I sometimes say that a lot of novels are like short stories on steroids, because there's just not enough story there to support like 400 pages or whatever, and so they do draw out, there's exposition or whatever. And what have you found different about writing short fiction versus writing book length novels, as far as the structure, maybe the movement of the story?
Yeah, they're really different to me. I mean, I think of short stories as kind of like a punch in the face. I mean, they're, you know, it's one sitting and bang, it should have an impact. I think that a novel needs more uniformity in order to give a fully satisfying experience. So, you know, there needs to be a degree of character development and change and a certain type of narrative scope in order to really hold a full novel, not like what you're saying, where it feels like a short story on steroids. But with a short story, I think there are fewer rules. You've got your traditional yarns, which, you know, you take a 6,000-word short story and you can break it into 1,500-word increments, and you just have sort of the, you know, the escalation and then the twist and then, you know, it moves in a different direction in the midpoint. They can be somewhat formulaic and actually quite good. I mean, there were tons of these adventure stories written back in the pulp era that I just love. They were written that way. But I think that a lot of short stories don't necessarily need to work that way. You look at, you know, for example, Tim O'Brien, a guy who wrote The Things They Carried, and some of the stories he has that are, you know, two or three pages long, and they just punch you in the gut. And I just, I think with a short story, you have a lot more room for structural creativity, and, you know, fewer rules. I also find short stories to be very difficult to write. So I try never to write short stories now. I go to the page with an idea, and I'm like, ooh, you know, that'd be a great short story to write. And then I sit down, and it's hard. It's really, you know, and I'm used to sort of stretching my legs with a novel. I find it very, very difficult to write a short story. And it takes a lot of time. You know, you can do a pretty good chunk of a novel in the time that it takes to knock. At least I can. I can do a pretty good chunk of a novel in the time that it takes to put together and polish a short story. I mean, sadly, there just aren't as many readers for short stories.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I'm wondering if that's changing somewhat with like Kindle Shorts and so on, and that sort of thing. But
I agree. So.
Yeah.
I think so. I think that we live in an interesting time in that sense. I also think that the novella is, you know, it's already gaining a lot of speed, obviously, because of e-books. But I think that the novella is going to continue to become a very strong form. I just think it's sort of the sweet spot for e-books. You know, you get something that's 150, 200 pages long, or even 100 pages long, and it's satisfying. People can sit down, they can read it quickly, but it still has enough meat to it. And those traditionally have sort of fallen by the wayside, I think, with traditional publishing, print publishing. But in E, I think we'll see more and more of those.
Susie, have you done some novellas?
I have, actually, and I'm actually really on board with what John was saying, because I have been working on a collection of novellas that are going to come out next summer, but I agree with you. I see a lot of movement with, well, of course, I write for romance, so, you know, I write romantic suspense and all sorts of different kind of subgenres within romance, and so, but I see a lot of movement with my novellas, because I think people do like sort of that shorter read. I like long books, but I want to have enough time to read them. So I'll bring a long book on vacation with me or something like that. But for a weekend read or a Friday night, give me a novella, and I'm super happy with that. And I think a lot of readers are heading that direction. So I think John's spot on with that.
Yeah, I think that I enjoy all the forms. I love short stories and haven't read as many in recent years, but traditionally I've read a lot of short stories. And like you said, you know, if I know I've got a nice block of time, I love to sink into a novel or even, you know, a monster novel and just really get that luxury liner experience. But a novella is great. You know, if you've got a Kindle or something and you have 15 minutes a night to read before you go to sleep, then it's nice to wake up and have a couple of percent knocked off, you know, versus you're reading Game of Thrones and, you know, 2 months pass by and you're still, you know, you've moved at 1%. So I think there's a place for all of it. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how this goes for you within novellas. I'm always interested when friends try these.
Yeah.
And so far it seems to be working really well for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think, you know, readers like a mix, like you said. Like, I'll have a big, huge book that I'll be reading, and I'll read, like you said, one chapter a night, just do, like, 1%. But then if I want something, maybe I have 3 hours. I don't want to read that book. I'll read, like, the novella. And so, yeah. I'm kind of curious to see how this works as well.
Yeah.
I have a whole slew of them coming out next summer, and we'll just see if they move
exciting.
Or don't move. We'll see.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, tell us a little bit about action and suspense in the stories that you work on. I mean, your stories are obviously very, not testosterone-driven, but, I mean, action-driven and strong male protagonist that unashamedly fights for justice and all of this. And as you I don't know if you outline beforehand or write organically. It's always interesting to hear people's approach, but, mm-hmm. but what are some of the secrets or techniques for including and escalating the action and suspense as stories move forward?
Yeah, you know, I just go back to what Vonnegut said about do horrible things to your characters. That way, we'll see what they're made of.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always hoping to go with you know, something surprising. I'm always hoping to go with something not just popping up and happening, but there being a sequence of things, one thing leading to another. I try not to settle with the first idea that comes in my head unless it's one of those things that just boom, pops out, and you go, oh, this is it, you know. if there's any hesitation whatsoever, if it feels kind of easy, I do this little thing that it's the most pragmatic name in the world. I call it List 6, and I just make sure that I list 6 different options so that so that I will always force myself to think through 6 different things that could happen, you know, here.
I love it. That's great. So, yeah.
That's
yeah,
really good. I love that too.
But yeah, I think in terms of suspense and action, it's just that we want to continue to challenge our characters in new ways. And going back to Vonnegut's quote, I really do think that action must reveal character. And that's what keeps people riveted. It's not just whether or not they win or lose. It's just to see how these people deal, how they cope, how they overcome their weaknesses, how they have to change in order to succeed, how they deal with setbacks. I mean, to me, it almost always comes back to character and emotion. You know, that's where, as a writer, that's where my investment is.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to cook up obstacles. It's fun to write fight scenes and jumping off cliffs and stuff like that. But but in the end, I don't feel like it's really firing on all cylinders unless there's some type of emotional movement there.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, we hear that over and over. You know, I've done a number of these different interviews, and it keeps coming up that's what people come to stories for, is an emotional connection, an emotional experience. And how do we actually draw them into that? That's powerful, and that's really at the core, I think, of all great storytelling is
mm-hmm.
drawing people in and letting them, you know, emotionally. And even in a short story, you know, like, John, you were mentioning some short stories and how in a couple of pages it's like a sock in the face, like, what?
Yeah.
You know, and it's this powerful emotion. And you could hopefully draw that out and,
I think the only way to really do that, and I'm sure there are more talented writers who have a better arsenal than I do, but I think the only way for me anyway to really do that is to be emotionally connected yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a tough one to fake. I really do.
Yeah, no, that's good. Now, I know that you worked with a major TV network in the production of the series Intelligence, and
right.
Which I enjoyed it, by the way.
Okay.
And I think the last time I saw you up in New York City, we chatted a little bit about it. But sometimes we hear mixed reactions from authors who've worked with filmmakers.
Right.
Without, you know, dissing anyone, tell us a little bit about that experience and, you know, maybe something you learned from it or somehow that it, you know, something that helped you grow through it or
sure.
something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm kind of a rarity in that I had a great experience working with Hollywood. Absolutely fantastic experience because I heard those stories too. And, you know, there are an awful lot of people, if you talk to them, they're like, oh, yeah, you can't trust anybody, you can't do this, you can't do that. And I had just the opposite experience. So, you know, it all started, I got a call, and the executive producer, Tripp Vinson, who had done a bunch of feature films, like the remake of Red Dawn and Number 23 with Jim Carrey and, you know, Journey to the Center of the Earth, Journey 2, he was interested. He hopped on I'm in Philadelphia. He hopped on a plane. I hopped on a train. We met in New York. We talked. And at the time, one of the first things I learned was, you know, you hear people never do anything unless they give you money. Well, Tripp said, look, this was in May. He wanted to, TV season is June, July, and he wanted to approach the networks, you know, in a month and a half or so. So he said, look, if you absolutely need it, I can get you money, but I'd really love it if we could just do a handshake deal. And then, you know, if I can't sell this thing in a month and a half or whatever, then it's all yours. All I'm asking is you just don't give it to anybody else in the meantime. So I said, sure. And, you know, we had connected. I could see we saw the story the same way. I was really excited by his credentials. You know, I wouldn't have made a handshake deal with just anybody. He obviously had gotten it done again and again and again. So, and he gave me a bit of great advice, too, when we sat there. He said, look, don't wait around for the ultimate success of the show in order to be happy, because there are a million ways for it to go wrong. Instead, celebrate every hurdle that we cross. And it was excellent advice, and I've told a lot of people this story because it really is my big takeaway. So every time something good happened, like when the head writer and showrunner, Michael Seitzman, came on board, I celebrated. And it's funny because when I received the initial call, I was having a hot dog at this, my favorite restaurant, this little hot dog place. It's like a roadside stop called Jimmy John's. It's on a busy highway. It's been there since 1940. I mean, it's like not exactly where you expect to be when you get a life-changing call. But, yeah, that's the truth. So every time, I'm kind of superstitious, every time something good would happen, I'd celebrate by going to Jimmy John's hot dogs, taking my wife, talk about how great it was. And so, yeah, every time something good, and then, you know, Josh Holloway signed on, he went to Jimmy John's and had a hot dog. And it just progressed and progressed. We kept clearing hurdles and clearing hurdles, and we really weren't supposed to make it. I mean, if you looked at all the pundits on the internet, thought we were not going to get picked up. But we just kept making it, and I kept celebrating and tried not to pin all my hopes on the ultimate success. I tried to really enjoy the ride. Mm-hmm. Finally, when CBS picked it up as a pilot to be shot, we were one of 11 at that point, one of 11 dramas. So we were looking at about two spots. So we knew the odds were still long, but it was such a big deal. We went above and beyond the hot dog, and my wife and I went out to Vancouver and visited the set, and so that was a good time. And ultimately, even though we weren't supposed to make it, and everybody online was saying we weren't going to make it, we did. And it was basically a year after I'd sat down with Tripp in the first place, you know, I got the call and found out that intelligence had been picked up by CBS. And yeah, it was pretty fantastic. And Tripp called that afternoon, and I remember it was a beautiful May day, and I was just pacing back and forth on the deck. And he goes, hey, you remember when I talked about, you know, all those hurdles? And I was like, yep. And he said, well, we just crossed the last one, and it was just amazing. Yeah. So I would say to anybody who gets involved in Hollywood, to evaluate any opportunity based on your gut and by, you know, the people with whom you're working. I don't think that, you know, you can say only do it if there's money. It really depends on the people you work with and how you feel about it. And then the second thing is just what Tripp told me. I would say celebrate every hurdle. So if somebody expresses interest in your book, you don't have a deal yet, you know, you should feel great. That's awesome that somebody is interested. If somebody options your work and they never exercise the option, celebrate that option. It's great. You know, and then you'll never be disappointed. I think it would be horrible to be holding back. Like, you don't want to jinx it or something. And then, you know, you go get all these amazing people on board, you get down line and you never celebrate it, and you miss it by one. You know, that would just be horrible. And the whole experience feels bad. One last thing. sorry for rambling, but the people. I just mentioned you have all these great people on board. I think that, that's another big takeaway from my Hollywood experience is that you just have an opportunity to work with some really great people, smart people, knowledgeable people, and really, really nice. You know, like they talk about writers not being treated well. My wife and I went to the set. It was a night shoot. We got there maybe 8:30. It was a rainy night in Vancouver. And, you know, it's dark, and we come down out, and the executive producers came out into the rain to greet us.
Sure.
I mean, it's not – we were treated like gold there. They surrendered their seats to us in the video village, and we sat there, and they explained everything to us. It was great.
Wow.
And I'm really happy to have those connections now, you know. And
yeah.
I just feel like you know, if you get into an opportunity working with Hollywood, you know, just don't be a pain in the butt, you know. Be just like in regular publishing. You want to be a good professional person, you know, be easy to work with, and that never hurts anything.
Yeah.
I think that's good advice on so many levels.
Yeah, it's a great story. Very encouraging, too. It's like, oh, that's great to hear because, you know, we often will get little, you know, bids from Hollywood or whatever, and it's always like, okay, do we go with that? Do we not? So love that idea of celebrating with each step, and I think that gives it the right perspective.
Yeah, I really believe that, and, you know, it's right on so many levels. I mean, it's just quality of life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's so much value in positive energy. I don't know. Maybe my personal experiences have proved it out, but it's if I'm down about stuff doesn't go well. But if I, you know, hope for the best and keep my self working and upbeat, then things tend to work out. And
yeah.
You know, and this happens a lot. You know, a lot of good things happen to people. I have many friends who have deals at various stages in Hollywood, you know, right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, it can happen to any of us. You know, I was a completely unknown author when this happened. Phoenix Island hadn't even been sold when they came to me. So, I mean, we can't lose hope. We just have to be ready when it comes.
Well, that's great. That's very cool. And you also consulted on some of the stories with the series. Are there any screenwriting or hints or tips or secrets of the trade that you picked up through that experience that other writers might be able to benefit from?
You know, I wasn't in the writer's room. So the screenwriting piece of it, not so much. One thing that I really learned from is sort of the converse. I've learned that there's a big difference between writing novels and writing for TV. And I think it behooves us to you know, work off of our strengths and not agonize over our weaknesses. So I did not try to interject myself in that sense. Instead, I stuck to the concepts. I stuck to the ideas. I had a lot of fun talking about ideas and possibilities as we went. Because the book and the show ended up having very little to do with one another. I mean, they really look nothing alike. At first, they were supposed to be close to one-to-one, and then it went through various stages. And the end product looked very much like a CBS TV show, not at all like my book, which was smart, you know. I mean, it evolved into that other form. TV and books are very different. But I think that if you want to write for television, or if you want to write movies, though I think there's a lot more in common between movies and novels. If you want to write for TV, you really got to spend your time with those guys. You know, figure out, read a ton of TV scripts, watch a ton of TV shows, and really follow what they have to say. I'd just lead somebody astray.
Well, you definitely have the secrets to good storytelling and good novel writing. And
well, thanks.
Yeah, and your new book, Devil's Pocket, now, we want all of our listeners to go and order a copy today. Is there anything you want to tell us about it? Or I don't want to give anything away, but if there's anything you want to share before we close up here today, that would be amazing.
All right, thanks. Yeah, I mean, Devil's Pocket is the sequel to Phoenix Island. Phoenix Island introduces this guy, Carl Freeman. And, you know, by the time Carl survives the first book, he's still in a really tough spot. And in the second book, he has been augmented. So he's sort of this teen super soldier. And he's tough. He's, I don't just mean that he can punch and kick and run fast stuff. I mean, he's just a very tough guy. So I knew that I had to throw him up against a really tough, a tough situation. So in Devil's Pocket, he's sent to this secret underground fighting tournament called the Funeral Games, based on the ancient Greek funeral games. And when he gets there, he has to compete against all these top fighters from around the world in different styles. But then things get complicated when he realizes there's a lot of other things going on. So it's kind of a cross between Bloodsport or Enter the Dragon and Mission Impossible, because there's a lot of espionage.
Yeah.
In between the fight scenes, there's a lot of investigation and mystery and espionage. So
fun.
It was a lot of fun, and I'm just thrilled to see the positive reactions to it. You know, I don't know about you guys, but when I write something, everything I write, I go through these periods, I'm like, this is the stupidest thing anybody's ever written in the world.
Yes.
You know?
And, oh, goodness.
And it was really hard with this one, because the first book did pretty well, you know, and people seemed to really like it and everything. And I'm like, well, here comes the other shoe, you know. It's like, I don't know. I struggle with self-doubt. And, and you know, there were times when I dug it, but there were times when I was like, man, I'm afraid, you know. So it's been really great. I'm so thankful to all the readers who go out and give it a shot, and I'm just overjoyed to hear people are enjoying it. And I'm nothing short of shocked to hear people say again and again, like, "Hey, it's better than the first one." I just, I'm really happy, and thanks for asking me about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so what would be the best place for people to keep up to speed on either new books that you have or appearances or signings you might do, website or Facebook? How can people get in touch?
You know, I'm most active on Facebook, but I'm under John Dixon Books. So it's JohnDixon Books. And my website is just that, johndixonbooks.com. My Facebook is blah, 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 / John Dixon Books. And Twitter's, that's also my handle on Twitter. So,
oh, nice.
But most active on Facebook, and I do make an attempt. There's definitely, the website has all the important information, including links to Twitter and Facebook. And then on Twitter, I'm not that great. I come on once in a while, but I put most of my time into Facebook, and that's a lot of fun connecting with people there.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Well, fantastic. John, man, it's been an honor to have you with us today, and of course we absolutely wish you the best and with the new projects that you might have, and we also thank all the listeners for being here today. And for my books, for info about what I'm writing and Blur and Fury, a couple of my teen books, young adult books, they're available on Amazon.com or go to StephenJames.net. And Susie?
Yeah, for my books, you can go to SusanMayWarren.com. And I do story coaching at LearnHowToWriteANovel.com as well.
And for more info about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to TheStoryBlender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.